Dallas Theological Seminary's Chapel Podcast.
In 1926, Dallas Seminary established the W.H. Griffith Thomas Memorial Lectureship in honor of William Henry Griffith Thomas, one of the founding fathers of Dallas Seminary. Over the years, the academic departments have taken turns in inviting prominent evangelical scholars to deliver the lectures that are designed to be a scholarly treatment of significant issues in various fields of study and vocational experience. One purpose of the lectureship is to provide the seminary community with an exposure to a variety of scholars from differing theological perspectives, yet within evangelical Christianity. This year, the Pastoral Ministries Department has invited Dr. Thomas Oden as our guest lecturer for this week of extended chapel services. Dr. Thomas Oden is a Methodist theologian, the Henry Anson Butts Professor of Theology and Ethics Emeritus at Drew University in New Jersey, and the director of the Center for Early African Christianity. His recent publication, How Africa Shaped the Christian Mind, discusses the importance Africa has held in the spread of the Christian faith in the past few centuries. Dr. Oden holds degrees from SMU, Yale, and Asbury. He studied at Heidelberg University, the University of Texas, Gregorian University, Moscow State University, and Oxford University. He has taught at Yale, SMU, Phillips University, and Drew University. His theological associations include the American Theological Society, the Evangelical Theological Society, the Wesleyan Theological Society, the Fellowship of Catholic Scholars, Society for Values in Higher Education, the American Academy of Religion, North American Patristic Society, and the Oxford Patristic Institute. His publications are longer than my life history. And I won't give you all of those. If you want to go online and do a little research on our speaker this week, you would find that he has been an incredible contribution to the field of theology in his own writing of systematic theology, but also his interest in patristics. He was married to his wife, Adrita, for 46 years before the Lord took her home now 10 years ago. And they have three children, and he currently resides in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Dr. Oden, we welcome you to Dallas Theological Seminary, to our campus, and to this week of chapels. Would you join me in welcoming Dr. Tom Oden?
Thank you. Thank you so much, Dr. Bailey. It's such a great pleasure to be here, great honor. It takes me back to a very deep level of memory and contentment, coming back to Dallas. Here, my new bride and I spent 3 years as a ministerial student and wife. And then here in Dallas, I mean, not here in the Dallas Theological Seminary, but we spent 2 more years after Yale as an assistant instruction at SMU. Not many blocks away from here, I served as a youth pastor in Central Congregational Church. I don't know what that church is now, but that was back in 1955. That is 50-plus years. Though Perkins and Dallas were only something like 5 miles apart, they were much further apart in psychological distance, exegetical method. As a student at SMU, I would never have imagined either that I would have ever been invited here or that I might ever lose touch with my own former alma mater. Since I wrote Requiem in 1995, I've come back several times to seminaries in the Metroplex area and in the state, all of them evangelical. But I've remained under a bit of a cloud of, generously you might say, ambiguity in the mainline seminaries, especially those that advertise their inclusiveness. There is a little irony in that, if you look for it. So it's especially gratifying to me to be back here in Dallas with you now in a place I never would have imagined that I would be sleeping softly and comfortably as I did last night in Swiss Tower and speaking in the chapel that bears the name of Lewis Berry Schaeffer, from whom I have learned so much in the preparation of my own systematic theology, and speaking in the W.H. Griffith Thomas lectures. These are exegetical guides that have been for me for many years very important, especially since 1973 when I left Bultmann behind and joined the Church Fathers. I'm honored and I'm humbled to be here. Danny, if you'll go on to frame two, I want to be offering for publication a more fully annotated and explicit argument than is possible within these brief minutes in the lectures, but those of you that might be interested in a more complete version, at least a draft of it, will be available in your library on the reserve shelf, but not to be circulated, since I will continue to tinker with it as we all, as authors do, until the very last day before the final version. I want to introduce this series with these thoughts. First of all, Christian believers on the continent of Africa have a distinguished intellectual history that awaits their own discovery. But ironically, in subtle ways, they seem to have been barred access to it as a result of preconceived ideas and certainly biases. So the early African heritage has remained sadly unnoticed even in Africa. It's not only Westerners who have ignored early African Christianity, it's also tragically many African scholars and religious leaders themselves, educated for the most part in the West and under the premises of modern consciousness. The decades since African independence movements in the 1950s, those decades have been intensively focused on condemnation of modern colonialist Christian missionary history. It's thorough, it's saturated, and it is in most ways legitimate. But meanwhile, at this same time, the last 50 years, 60 years, these same writers have hardly glimpsed their own pre-modern, distinctly African Christian texts. These texts are the actual foundation of a worldwide Christian intellectual heritage. Even my esteemed black theology friends and colleagues who have rediscovered many fertile aspects of what they call traditional African religion seem to have consistently ignored the intellectual depth and the deposit of faith in early Africa itself. So these are texts that we have. They're in your library, most of them, quite a few of them translated. They are a gift of the first millennium to the third millennium, or this new millennium, let's say. They're gifts that are lying there at our feet, but it seems that they're almost too close to us to get in focus. Most critics have remained stuck exclusively on this mood of anti-colonialist revulsion. So the gift that is wrapped in papyrus texts of the African church mothers and fathers and martyrs and classical scriptural exegetes comes from early Africa. Many of their names are still quite unfamiliar to us. Listen to their names: Januaria, Gennarassa, Vestia, Donata, Secunda. All of those happen to be women among the first martyrs of Africa. That's 180 AD, that's in Skilly. Others include Perpetua and her maid Felicitas, who, by the way, was 8 months pregnant when she stood before the Roman judge for condemnation and martyrdom, 203. And then the men's names, Didymus the blind, Ammonius, Pacomius, Optatus, they don't easily spring quickly to mind or off the tongue. Unlike others from Africa that we do know, like Cyprian and Tertullian and Origen, Athanasius and Augustine. Ordinary lay people, and particularly those in Africa, need more accessible way of understanding the great import of these early Christians from their own continent, their faith, their tenacity, their remarkable intellectual intensity. And that's why this story is ready to be retold. It must be accurately told. It must be told without any ideological distortions. The story itself is far more dramatic than anything rhetoric could add to it. Christian scholars do well to leave it to Muslim scholars to tell the story of early Islam in Africa. But we have the privilege of telling the Christian story in Africa. And happily, it does not require any particular skin pigment to tell it. We're on frame three now, when Libya was Christian. What I think these lectures do provide an opportunity for, it is a unique opportunity, to learn something about the faith once for all delivered to the saints in a particular distant location. The location is as distant as Ethiopia, and yet it is very close to worldwide believers who hold to Orthodox classic Christian teaching. Your opportunity and your investment of time this week in these chapel services is to learn about a people of faith, Christian believers in Libya. Let's go to frame four, Danny. I dare say this is a subject about which you've heard very little, maybe nothing. Just ask yourself a moment and think for a moment. Can you name, or can I name, a single believing Christian or writer or biblical interpreter from Libya? That's a good starting point. If not, you are just at the point that I was not very long ago. Few years ago. And this is a condition that can be corrected. Libya is the most neglected of all important Christian locations in the ancient world, locations that have experienced 500 years of Christian history. That's why I've made it recently my first priority and focus to try to break some new ground in the study of early African Christianity. Not just of Libya, but of the whole arena of texts written in Africa in the first millennium. But in Libya itself, there is less archaeological excavation, although quite a bit, still less, than, let's say, Tunisia or Algeria. Far less rigorous literary inquiry, less architectural analysis, or less artistic criticism than you find in Algeria, Tunisia, Egypt, and Ethiopia and the Sudan. All of those have far greater body of literature than Libya. Now, you go to Jerusalem, you go to Istanbul, you go to Antioch, you go to Cairo, and you will see abundant evidences there of Christianity in its early period. But you go to sites in Libya like Cyrene or Leptis Magna, try to find the buried Christian evidences. That was my problem. You're going to instantly discover how hard they are to identify despite their long and once prominent history. But they are there, believe me. You consult the literature. Most of it is in Italian, French, German, Arabic, some of it in Polish, and you will see that there's only a smattering compared to the other great ancient sources and traditions. And make note how little English there is there, very, very little. So you see what labor is required to even get to the facts. And you basically have to dig it out of scattered archaeological journals and old excavation reports. Frame four, we've got frame four, map of Libya. Christianity was once a prevailing presence in Libya, and for a long time, roughly from 325 to 643. Now Christians are less than 1% of the citizens of Libya. Most of these are Catholics of Italian descent, living in an almost 100% Sunni Muslim culture. Go back to frame three, if you would, Danny. I'm on personal retrospect on recent conversations in Libya. When I responded happily to an invitation to lecture in Libya in February 2008, I was afraid of stepping on toes. I had been asked to speak on the centuries of pre-Arab history in Libya to Islamic students, university students, and to the interested diplomatic community there in Tripoli. This was just at a time when the United States, the State Department, was weighing a Libyan proposal for compensation on the Lockerbie settlement. The other hard news that was going on at that time when I was in Libya was the accelerating relief crisis in Libya, in Libya's neighbor, the Darfur section of Western Sudan. So the first rough presentation of the key ideas of these lectures in Dallas occurred in Tripoli, capital of Libya, February 24, 2008, at Dawa Islamic University and at the 17th century Cathedral of St. Mary's in the Medina, near the old castle of Tripoli, in the oldest part of the ancient Punic Greek Roman Byzantine city. My subject was the early history of Christianity in the first millennium in Tripoli, before the Arab victory of 643. These lectures were presented on the invitation of the university and the Anglican primate of North Africa and the Horn of Africa, along with the generous cooperation of the civil government of Libya. At the university, I met students from all over Africa. They were studying Arabic, and they were studying Sharia law. That means the history of commentary on the Quran as it applies to judgments in the legal system. That's what Sharia law means. These students brought respectful and thoughtful and penetrating questions to me concerning the part of Libya's history in which I have a special interest. Namely, the remaining evidences of significant Christian presence in Libya from the 3rd to the 7th century. That seems esoteric, but I found the whole conversation very enlightening, even having a quality of urgency. I experienced in those students an ardent motivation and an open desire to listen to a Western Christian voice that appreciated aspects of Libyan history and early African history that have been seldom noticed in the last 1,500 years. Many of these students studying in Libya were not Libyan. They came from all over Africa. This was an Islamic university teaching Islamic faith, and these students were eager to hear and to go one-on-one with a Christian scholar from the United States. And it was in a good spirit. sharing the implications of what I learned. In these lectures, I've selected that shadowy part of African Christianity that has been least studied by modern scholars, and yet it is now, thankfully, growing in accessibility to modern visitors to North Africa. It's this vast and baffling country of Libya. Libya is to Africans a little bit like Alaska is to Americans. Vague, distant, and intriguing. Libya is the second largest landmass in Africa and the least known to North Americans. What I want to do here is to try to woo you like a lover into a place that you might not otherwise ever go. Into the fascinating orbit of a subject you probably do not think you need to know. A world far away, an African world long gone. Never have I before faced such a self-chosen impediment in public lectures. That is, to speak on a subject about which there is minimal precipitating concern. And a subject which is hard to explain, and about which there is little predisposing motivation even to listen to its passionate concerns. These are all things that Mrs. Peterson taught me as my high school speech teacher always to avoid. So let the folly continue. I have chosen voluntarily to try to elucidate a remote topic in a sufficiently interesting manner that you will want to come back for all four of these sessions. That's my personal goal. But what passion fuels such craziness? What could make it so important to me at this time in my life? Maybe it could be important to you. Well, Libyan Christianity epitomizes the struggle of world Christianity, in my view. What makes it so urgent? Its issues are arising in a part of the world that is set in the front trenches of the battle lines of North-South conflict, of East-West conflict, of Muslim-Christian conflict, and the very future of Christian mission in the Global South and the Global North. Why was I welcomed there under these circumstances with visa blockages, Lockerbie, Darfur, polarization? Well, first of all, because I was a guest. Nothing I deserved. I was a guest of the university and the government, and also a guest of my esteemed friend, Archbishop Munir Annis of the Anglican Church there. There is a profound North African tradition of hospitality and cordial treatment of guests at your table. Secondly, I did not represent any political interest whatever, either Libyan or Western, but only matters of historical inquiry. And yet, it seemed immediately evident to me that simply by being there, I was already empathizing with a subtle point of Libyan self-esteem, you might say, pride. The positive rediscovery by an American of Libyan history. And it didn't take them long to connect my non-economic concerns, my non-political concerns, with their practical sensibilities regarding the future economic developments in tourism as an injector of capital into the contemporary Libyan economy. By the way, the Libyan economy ranks as one of the wealthiest in Africa, based on oil exports, which account for somewhere between 92 and 97% of Libya's revenues. This income is dispersed by a top-down, socially planned system of distribution, largely administered through government agencies, all essentially under the control of one man, one family. Everything that is done in this political order is done as a result of what strikes me as basically a socialist vision and what I would call Islamic communitarianism, plus a strong dose of, softened by a strong dose of Sunni family ideals, Sunni Muslim. My generous friend and driver and keeper who was with me every step along the way, reminded me that I was moving through a system that featured a complete state-controlled monopoly of power, but surprisingly one that is now seeking partnerships with free economies and more egalitarian visions. Now, as an invited guest, I had the privilege of not having to struggle for my civil liberties. Along the way, I met some people there that certainly would have had great difficulty obtaining even a modicum of civil liberties to speak as I was able to speak. For example, I met a young man there who wanted advice about coming to North America to study. He was in ministry. I got acquainted with him briefly after one of the lectures. I had dinner last night with Paige Patterson. He asked me, what was the one memory that I had that was most stunning and striking to me? And I told him about this story of this young man who came to me. And he turns out to be from Chad or from some, I'm not even sure exactly which country it was, but Central African Republic or one of the countries right in the middle of the Saharan, South Saharan Desert. And he had been serving a very tough ministry there in Tripoli, among the poorest of the poor, among the most forgotten and alienated people in Tripoli. And when I asked how he got there, I was stunned with the answer. He said, "I walked." I couldn't believe it. I told Paige, that represented to me the incredible determination and aspiration of young people, bright young people in Africa, walking across that. I don't see how he survived. I was not able to get his name. It happened too quickly, but it impressed itself strongly on my memory. I'm just trying to explain why, to my complete surprise, I, as an evangelical Christian theologian from the West, who happens to be interested in Libyan history, got a very welcome reception without having to cheat on my basic commitments to Christian scripture, doctrine of revelation, Christology, triune teaching. Well, I think the answer to that, why did I get that reception, was because they perceived my report on Libya as if it were, we were all a part of a family and we had a share in a gold mine that we didn't even know we had. It was as if we were discovering together that there was something immensely valuable which if the world knew about, it would want to come and see. But nobody's looking. Nobody, especially in Libya, because it's all marked with a cross. It's marked with a lot of Christian symbols, Alpha, Omega, and other things. Next frame is the newness of old stones, the archaeological testimony. There are about a half a dozen historic sites in Libya that are absolutely spectacular. Chief among these are Leptis Magna, Sabratha, and Cyrene. Now, and there are many others, but in each one of these, there are remnants of early Christian history that have been buried for centuries under layers of sand. Most have been only partially excavated intermittently in a number of decades. And they have lain there silently, almost in a pristine state, without having layer after layer of urban sprawl built on top of them. That's what makes the whole scene archaeologically so interesting. The Islamic victory in Libya and all over North Africa was absolute and totally expulsive. That is, Christians were simply expelled, unable to remain, or they had to convert to Islam in 643. But in my Tripoli lecture, I was just simply working on factual historical narrative. What were Christians doing there in Libya? Why were they there so long? What did they write and build and sing and make? What artistic and architectural remains did they leave behind? This is a nourishing slice of Libyan history that was perceived by my Islamic audience as surprisingly connected with their own present struggle, which is a struggle for identity, for respectability in the modern world, for prestige. Their struggle is to gain first line membership in the international community. Their struggle is to be a major player in technological development. And they are basically determined to be moderate Muslims. There is a great resistance there to the Wahhabist movement that comes out of Saudi Arabia. They want to have a voice, and they are ready, I believe, for Western scholarship and dialogue. It's interesting to me that they did not ask me the question that I so often get in American university and also seminary audiences. They did not ask me, why study history? I never got that question. They already know why history is important because they study it all the time. That's what their study is. Their study is with sacred texts. That's all they do. Now, in addition to this university audience, I also spoke to an international audience of diplomats and Christian believers who are living in Libya. This was in the ancient Medina, the historical center of the Libyan culture in Tripoli. We went into it was held in a former Catholic church that has now been restored and offered for use to the Anglican communion with an international congregation composed mostly of teachers and diplomats and refugees from all over Africa, many other parts of the world. These are not cradle Anglicans. They form an intensely believing community of Christians coming from all over Africa who adhere really quite fervently to scriptural classical Christian teaching. I learned that if they could see me as a person who cares about them, and who's capable of some empathy with their dilemmas, if they could see me as a person who is not hostile, unless there's some reason for it, then they weren't going to write me off. They're going to listen to me and take seriously how they might benefit from what I'm saying. Now, what I will be presenting this week here in Dallas is a follow-up, really, to the theme of a book just recently published by University Press called How Africa Shaped the Christian Mind. Subtitled The African Seedbed of Rediscovering the African Seedbed of Western Christianity. And the basic point of that book is that we have a very long, distinguished textual history of profound intellectual contributions of Christians in early Africa. And that rich wisdom of early African Christian writings still has astonishing relevance, in my view, for the problems that remain in Africa today. What are these problems? We all know them. Economic justice, diseases of the worst sort, displaced persons, War, children in war, abuse of children, abuse of women, the innocent, and many, many more. All of these still already present in the texts and the struggle of early African Christianity are still fresh. So why is Libya worth watching? Partly because the huge scale of Christian architecture in ancient Libya has been completely unavailable to a Western audience and especially to an American audience. And it is gradually, not easily being opened, but it is gradually being opened for travel. Meanwhile, Meanwhile, Libya remains still as almost completely dismissed as an area of interest that could be pertinent to world Christianity. There's only a very slight awareness among Christians that there still are Christian believers in Libya. And this includes Copts, Catholics, Evangelicals, and some various forms of Orthodox believers. There are, of course, no overt evangelical mission activities in the usual mission sense. Sharia law prevents personal evangelization and much freedom of assembly and property ownership. If you stand out on a street corner with a pamphlet and give it to somebody, you, under law, could easily go to jail, straight to jail. But in practice, there are highly committed Christian businessmen who are also believers who are gathering on an informal friendship basis, on the basis of personal networks in house churches and small groups. The evangelicals in Tripoli are largely composed of Arabic-speaking African evangelicals who have been permitted to live or visit in Africa because of their businesses. Some are there with, some without government papers. The government permits continued presence and limited freedom of assembly for historic churches that have a history of having been there for a long time. This includes, as I said, the Orthodox, Coptic, Catholic, and Anglican, to a lesser extent, a generic evangelicals. If you happen to be a Presbyterian, it's a little bit better than if you're anything else, because there is some precedent there. The standard methods of evangelism that are supported by ministries from abroad are simply not viable in Libya. They can't happen. They will not happen. They will be found out and deported. Ironically, these methods are now being utilized, however, by the Muslims themselves in the building of mosques all over Africa. Medical centers are being built by Islamic medical centers, Islamic educational institutions. Lots of money is going in all over Africa, every corner of Africa, to bring indigenous leadership to raise up indigenous leadership for Islamic conversion. So that's a part of the reason why this is a trench area, a battleground area. Frame 7, Libya as a neglected source for world Christian intellectual history. We're talking about the most ignored place that has 5 centuries of Christian history. 5 centuries of Christian presence and culture. The ancient Christian period in Africa has been profoundly misunderstood by academics. It's been underreported by the media, and it's certainly been insufficiently excavated by the archaeologists. I think it wins the prize for absolute avoidance. It's as if it does not exist. It is as if an amnesia has gone into our heads concerning the 5 centuries of Christianity there. So these lectures hope to provide a very preliminary introduction to some of these neglected layers of great achievement of that tradition. Frame 8, the movement of intellectual history in the 3rd century has been from south to north. The 3rd century, the movement is from, put it geographically, from Africa to Asia and Europe. The chief intellectual guides and masters of North African Christianity have been studied by Christians all over the world. But they have not been recognized as African. It's been thought that they were Hellenists or Romans. They were not African, and yet they have been indigenized Africans for generations that were doing this great intellectual work of the 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th century. And some of that work was done in Libya. The basic ideas of African Christianity have remained quietly embedded in Catholic, Orthodox, evangelical missions all over the world, in India and China and the Americas, right here in Dallas Theological Seminary. Here I'm thinking of the ancient Christian writers of the African continent, not Livy alone, thinking of Tertullian, Cyprian, Clement, Origen, Athanasius, Augustine, Fulgentius, and many others, really. Contributors to developments in European and Eastern theology and church practice. These African writings have been studied and pondered for centuries, and they have impacted all subsequent generations of Christians of all modern cultures. However, they've never been studied as indigenous Africans, as people shaped by that great continent. I see that my time is up. I'll pick this thread up exactly here tomorrow.